Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life Podcast. My guest on today's episode is Andy Moore. Andy is the head basketball coach at Reynoldsburg High School near Columbus, Ohio. After spending 25-plus years as a Division I college assistant, Andy came back to the high school ranks and has built a terrific program at Reynoldsburg High School. He has a journey through high school, playing for his dad, and college, playing for the legendary Jim Bursum at Muskingum College, Division III school in the Ohio Athletic Conference, before starting his coaching career that saw him reach the highest levels of men's Division I college basketball. I hope you enjoy my visit today about basketball and life with Coach Andy Moore of Reynoldsburg High School. Hey, Coach John Cook here. And before we get to today's episode, I just wanted to take a quick second and let you know that we have officially launched our website. It's bballandlife.com. That's bballandlife.com. We encourage you to check out the website where you can access all of our content, and there's lots of other items available for you there. You'll get more on that later in the episode. Again, visit us if you would at bballandlife.com. Thanks again for listening to today's episode. Andy, I want to say thanks so much for joining me. This has been in the works for quite some time. The first time I reached out was back in the summer, and we've had to go through some different machinations to make this work. And I know it's a very busy time for all basketball coaches as we get ready to start the fall. So I just want to say thanks for doing this.
Well, I appreciate it, John. You know, it's I know we've emailed back and forth getting ready for this day. So I'm excited to be here and talk hoops with you.
Well, we're going to tell your story. And I say this all the time. People get tired of hearing me talk about how unique everyone's journey is in this game, and I think it's true that there's no two that are anywhere alike, but I'm not sure that I could have a guest on that's going to have a broader range of experiences that most people can't relate to. I think that's the part that makes your story most interesting, and I can't wait to tell it.
Well, I think it's been a long journey, but one I wouldn't trade. And so, you know, it's made me who I am now as far as a coach and a person. So I'm excited to talk with you about it.
Well, you are a couple of years older than me, which means you were in high school between 1984 and 88. I'm a 90 high school grad, but yeah. For anybody that's familiar with Andy Moore, they'll know the story. For any listeners that might be unfamiliar, talk a little bit about your background growing up in high school and then ultimately heading toward college and just your experience around the game.
It kind of started. My dad was a high school coach here in Ohio and a teacher for, 35 years. So, at an early age, I kind of realized if I was going to spend any time or much time with my dad, quality time, that I needed to start tagging along and going to the gym and watching his practices, watching him coach, watching his assistant coaches. And, that's where I kind of fell in love with the game. And, that kind of stayed with me, that I wanted to be a coach, and stayed with me through high school and college. My high school years, again, 84 to 88, I was at Mount Vernon. My dad was my coach. My dad's passed away, but, I can brag on him now because I wouldn't when he was alive, but he won a lot of games, and he was very successful. And so, we were fortunate. He just kind of developed a culture at Mount Vernon where, we felt like we were going to win. We were a disciplined team. We executed. We didn't do anything fancy, but we were just able to put together, 5, 6, even up to 10 years in a row where Mount Vernon had really good teams. And so a couple championship teams I was fortunate to play on. The conference I'm coaching in now is actually the one that I coached it or played in. Mount Vernon's not a member of the OCC anymore, but had some really good teams, a lot of success. Didn't ultimately get to where we wanted to go to our final stop, but, I enjoyed it. A lot of people ask how playing for your dad was, and, at times it was difficult. I always felt like, and he told me it was going to be this way, that he was going to be harder on me than anybody. And he had to, because, I was his son. So, that made some difficult times for he and I, but when I look back on it now, I wouldn't trade it for the world. It was a great experience. And again, 4 years where I got to spend a lot of time with him, and then, you know, moved on to college in the OAC at Muskingum University. Well, that was Muskingum College at the time. You know, I was probably like everybody else, you know, as a junior, senior in high school that, you know, maybe had a little bit of success. I thought I was going to play for Ohio State or Duke or North Carolina at some point. And, you know, my dad was obviously very reasonable and got it in my head early on. That is not going to happen. So, you know, my senior year, I started looking at those schools, and I was looking at Muskingum and Capital, Otterbein, Wittenberg. Those were some of the schools that were, you know, I really thought about going to. But, you know, Coach Burson at Muskingum, you know, he did a great job of recruiting me, and I decided that was going to be the best place to go, not only because, you know, the school and, you know, that what I wanted to maybe get into as far as a major, but also because he had a lot of coaching ties. For coaches that recruited Jay, his son, he got to know a lot of those people. And I was thinking down the road a little bit too, as far as I want to get into coaching. So I thought he would be a great one to be with for 4 years.
Well, Andy, that's a terrific perspective from a couple of standpoints for me. Number one, I talk to coaches on this podcast all the time about coaching their sons. I very seldom have given a lot of time on the podcast to the sons playing for their fathers. It's obviously a dynamic that's shared, but it's very different if you're the coach in that scenario versus being the player in that scenario. Can you talk a little bit about anything that you or your dad had to work through in terms of an ability to, or a necessity to draw a line somewhere where, you know, practice was over, games were over, and we were just at home?
Yeah, you know, we talked about that, you know, a lot before everything got started. You know, I thought I had the chance to play as a sophomore. And so, you know, we talked, that's a good question. We talked about that. And I think I remember we succeeded in doing this all the time. There was just one time where at home we talked about basketball in terms of what was going on at Mount Vernon, how we were playing. We just said, you know, when we leave the gym, we're leaving the gym, because the other guys on the team got to do that. And just because my dad was a coach, you know, it shouldn't be any different. So I remember, though, one time we were having a little bit of a rough stretch. So, you know, he and I sat down and talked one evening, but we just left it there. But, you know, we had some good times. We had some bad times. I wouldn't trade it for the world, but it was an interesting dynamic. You know how it goes. You know, people think, you know, you're playing because of who your dad is. And that was tempered a little bit because, you know, we won a lot of games. Not because of me, but we won a lot of games. And so it's hard for people to, you know, it's hard to say a whole lot when, you know, you're winning as much as we were. And you know, again, I was playing. So, you know, it was an interesting dynamic. You know, I wouldn't trade it for the world. You know, my sons are starting to get older now, and I, you know, think about wanting to coach them. And I think it's something I'd like to do, but my kids are 14, 11, and 7. At this point, I don't think they have any notion to want to play for me. They don't think I know what I'm doing. So at this point, I don't think they have any desire to play for me. Hopefully that'll change at some point.
Well, I'll share a little bit of my story with you before I ask my next question. I'm not sure my son ever really wanted to play for me either, but 3 weeks before his senior season started, all their coaches resigned and there was nobody left. So I ended up taking a high school job to coach my son as a senior, where he probably would have preferred it been somebody else too. But I would agree with what you said. I think from his perspective and mine, the rough patches were undeniable, but in general, the experience, and we only had it for a year, I'm quite certain that both of us would say, given what the way things unfolded, we certainly wouldn't change it. And I appreciate hearing you say that. What it leads me to want to ask, though, is when you spend a high school career playing for your dad, you're also playing for a very good coach. When you got to college, you were going to play for a legendary coach in Jim Burson. Did your experience playing for your dad and growing up with a coach in your home impact how you perceived what Coach Burson was doing and how you understood the way he operated in his office? And if so, what ways did it impact that?
It definitely did, because I think my father and Coach Burson's, you know, their philosophies towards the game were similar. You know, again, I mentioned earlier, you know, we didn't do anything flashy. You know, we tried to execute. We tried to take care of the basketball. We took good shots. We either played man to man or zone in a half court. We didn't stretch the floor at all and try to play up and down. And Coach Burson was the same way. I think those were the things that he believed in as well. And so that really helped. I felt like, you know, when I got to Muskingum, it was a culture shock at first. I mean, I don't think any high school experience can have you completely prepared for college. I mean, it's going to be different. You're going to play against better players, more athletic guys, the game's quicker and faster. So, you know, there's always a little bit of a change in the environment there, but yeah, playing for my dad, because I think they were similar, you know, certainly helped. He was, and Coach Burson, just like my dad, was, you know, disciplined. He was going to hold us accountable for things that we did. There weren't going to be any shortcuts. You know, we're going to do it the way they wanted it done, without any exceptions. And something, if you didn't agree with that or you didn't like that, you could find somewhere else to play. So that was, I thought that benefited me greatly, you know, playing for two coaches that were fairly similar in how they approached the game.
And when you go to play at Muskingum, you mentioned the other thing that kind of fascinated me was that you kind of had an idea that coaching was going to be in your future, and choosing Coach Burson, you actually were taking at least one step toward maybe setting up that future. I think that's fascinating to be that age and kind of have that perspective on it. And I'm almost sad that we can't. Like, I'd like to spend a podcast just letting you tell Jim Burson stories, because I think that would be a really good listen. But
I would, I'd have to change the language in a lot of them.
It's a podcast. We don't have to change anything. I could just label it explicit and we'd be fine.
It was very colorful at times, I'll say that.
Well, the interesting thing is you played for Jim Burson and I worked for Gail Doherty. And outside of the fact that they played very slow and that the game was low scoring and it was defensive oriented, I think the language was also very similar in Ada compared to what it was in New Concord, I think.
I bet it was. I grew up, you know, as a young kid, you know, my dad used to take me to Ohio Northern basketball camps. And although I didn't get the chance to hear that colorful language, when I look back at what those guys were like, and, you know, then, you know, playing against Coach Doherty, and seeing how he handled himself on the sidelines, and he and Coach Burson having similar philosophies, I kind of figured that maybe the language maybe was similar with Coach Burson.
Well, it's sad when guys like that can't do it forever, and when we could, again, spend a whole other podcast on that. But what I want to get into is, as you move toward the end of your college career and you had selected your college at least in part based on the idea that it would give you the best avenue into a career in coaching, were you expecting to coach high school? Were you thinking college was where you wanted to go? What was your kind of take early on as you're getting ready for graduation and preparing for that first step in a career?
You know, to be honest with you, John, I really did not have any interest in coaching in high school. You know, I, especially once I got to college and be around college basketball, you know, I was, you know, kind of, I had tunnel vision, and the goal was to be a Division I head basketball coach. And so that's what, you know, I wanted to do. That's, you know, what I worked for. Now, when I first left Muskingum, you know, there weren't any college jobs available. I think I, you know, tried to get a couple of GA positions. But it didn't work out. So I was my dad's freshman coach at Mount Vernon. So that's where I started. I was just fortunate at the time, the head coach at Kenyon was a guy by the name of Bill Brown. And Bill's son played for my dad. So got to know him that way. And when he lost his assistant at the time, it was Mike DeWitt, who's actually the head coach at Ohio Wesleyan now. When Mike left, Coach and I had a relationship, and he offered me the job, and I took it. So, and it was a great experience. I was with Coach Brown for 6 years, but I was just really fortunate because so many guys, you know, invested in me and were invested in my success. And so I was able to kind of move up at a pretty good pace. And then once I started to do that, you know, high school was even if it was a thought before, you know, I had no thoughts at that point to being a high school coach.
Well, and it's not hard to believe that you would have that approach because you coached freshman basketball. And I've always said about coaching freshman basketball is if the player gets any good, you lose him and you don't see him again until he sucks or his attitude's bad.
You know, it's funny. My 2 years as the coach, my first year, my dad took our two best players and moved them up to JV. And then my second year, he took our three best players and moved them up to JV. So my 2 years coaching, we won three games.
Yeah.
And although I complained a lot, you know, he would. And this is, I think, a lot of coaches' philosophy. He said, you know what? I couldn't care less whether you win any games or not at the freshman level. Develop the rest of the kids that are down there. So I'm like, yes, sir. You know, we'll do our best to do that. He wasn't worried about what my one-loss record was, obviously, with three wins in 2 years.
I tell you what, Andy, we're not going to spend a lot of time talking high school at the beginning of the pod here, but I always felt like in the programs that I ran as a high school coach, the two most important coaches on my staff were my seventh grade coach and my freshman coach, because my seventh grade coach, they needed to want to come back to basketball after seventh grade. And then that freshman year, they needed an experience because it's hard to be a freshman. You're either playing some freshman games, but not a full slate, or maybe you're playing a little bit of JV, a little bit of freshman. And a lot of kids can feel like they're in a shuffle that they bail on. I always felt like those spots were important. And again, not about the winning and losing. You're absolutely right about that. But let's chat about your time at Kenyon. You know, you and I had shared some information, and this is actually kind of when I think I didn't find you again, if you will. I obviously knew you as a college player because I was at Northern. We kind of overlapped a little bit. But your experience at Kenyon was, I think, if you, the information you sent me said 94 to 96. And yes. Kenyon basketball, for those who don't know, has kind of had a history of feast or famine, I think, to be fair. And that 94 to 96 time slot was an interesting time at Kenyon.
Yeah, it was. And I was fortunate, you know, when Coach Brown offered me the job, I was fortunate to come in when there was a really good senior class. They were going to be seniors, and they had probably won at a level, you know, above where Kenyon had won in the past. So going into their senior year, there was a lot of high expectations. And so, you know, the regular season was, I maybe say, a little bit disappointing. We didn't play as well as we wanted to, but we did get to the NCAA tournament. You know, we beat Worcester at Worcester in the second round, and you know, Worcester was really good. I'm probably, anybody's listening to this, Steve Moore is, you know, I'll say this, Coach Burson said he's maybe the best coach he's ever been around. So, you know, we were at Worcester. We were struggling. We got down big, but we managed to claw our way back in and win. So we went to the Sweet 16, and we lost to a Manchester team coached by Steve Alford. So, you know, that's kind of pretty neat, you know, story to tell. That was his first college coaching job. And, you know, obviously everybody knows what he was like as a player. And now, you know, as a head coach at Nevada, he's done really well wherever he's been. So that was that first year. And then the second year, you know, we got a kid that a lot of, I'm sure most people know, if not all of them, Shaka Smart.
Yep.
He came in as a freshman my last year at Kenyon, and he was really good. I mean, he maybe not a guy that could score, but you could just tell he was a leader on the floor. He was one of the best students in the country coming out of high school, made the right decisions, handled the ball, got people the ball in scoring positions. But after that first year, at least my first year, Coach Brown got the job at California University of Pennsylvania, and which is about 3 hours from Columbus. And, you know, he offered me an opportunity to come along, and I did. So we didn't coach Shaka those last 3 years, his last 3 years. But when Shaka finished up, he came out and was a GA for us. You know, those were really good times at Kenyon. You know, I think we won a lot more than maybe Kenyon has in the past or even since. So it was fun to be around there at that time and, you know, establish the relationships that you do. And I'll always consider myself, I'm a Division III guy, period. You know, I played Division III basketball. I started at Division III level. Wherever I've gone, I've never lost that thought or feeling that I have that that's the Division III level is, you know, the probably the place that I love the most.
Well, I'm going to put a pin in that one because we're definitely going to come back to that before the end of the podcast. I have a real affinity, obviously, for Division III and what it means to be a Division III guy. It's a little bit different for everybody in terms of why they are, and we'll come back to that. If you wouldn't mind, Andy, can you talk a little bit about or just try to compare and contrast maybe some of the things that you gained as a player under Coach Burson with some of the things that you gained in terms of being a coach while you were with Coach Brown, both at Kenyon and at Cal PA?
Well, you know, at that smaller level, especially, you know, with Coach Burson, you know, you learned how to, you know, again, one thing, you know, doing things the right way. You know, you learn, you know, toughness, physical and mental toughness. You know, we were a team that, again, we didn't do anything flashy, but the importance of executing, you know, every play. And there's going to be, you know, there's going to be limited possessions in a game, and you couldn't afford to waste any. And so that was really instilled in me with Coach Burson. We also, you know, we took a lot of pride in how we defended, just like Coach Doherty's teams at Ohio Northern. We took a lot of pride that way. And, you know, again, that's something I've taken with me as well. I joke around sometimes with my friend. Everybody talks about defense, defense, defense. And I joke when I say this, but I'm like, have you ever played in a game and you scored more points and lost? And they say, no. I said, well, you got to score the ball. I said, even with the most points at the end wins. But I joke around about that. You got to guard people because it's going to come down to that at the end of game. So, and then Coach Brown was a little bit different. He liked to get up and down the floor and play faster and, you know, maybe shoot quick threes and, you know, score in transition. And we, you know, we pressured some full court, whether it was man to man or zone. So I got a chance to look at, you know, kind of both sides as a player at the Division III level, and then as a coach at the Division III level. And then Coach Brown kept that philosophy when we went to Cal PA. Cal PA was, and it's still really good, Cal PA was one of the best Division II jobs in the country back then. And we had really good players, and we had good athletes. So, you know, we wanted to play fast. We wanted to pressure people. So I learned, you know, from both guys, you know, at the Division III level, you know, I learned two different styles of play and really two different styles of recruiting too, and, you know, personalities and how they handle certain, you know, certain situations. So I felt like I got a lot done. I learned a lot in those years at that level.
Well, after your time at Kenyon, you got on to what is, I guess, maybe the quintessential journey of the assistant coach at the college level. And we don't need to talk about every stop, but from Cal PA, you go to Eastern Michigan for 2 years, then at the University of Michigan for, I think, five. Yeah. I remember you were at Bowling Green State in 07-08, back to Eastern. And again, we could spend a full hour on each of those stops, but can you talk about the decision to go from Cal PA at D2, where you guys were building something that actually has became and has remained pretty special at that level, but the decision to head off to Eastern Michigan University, how did the opportunity come about, and what was kind of the big factor that sent you that direction?
Well, you know, as I said, the goal, you know, when I started out, I wanted to be a Division I head coach, but I did not know a lot of Division I people. I did not, you know, I hadn't been recruiting on a national level where, you know, you're out meeting people. So the one guy, the one staff I did get to know was Jim Boone at Robert Morris and his assistants. Coach Boone left Cal PA to go to Robert Morris, which is, you know, there in Pittsburgh. So, you know, I kind of studied how they played and looked at his, Coach Boone's teams, and they were really, really special teams. They had a lot of success. So, you know, I started developing a relationship. Our team doctor at Cal PA was still good friends with Coach Boone. So Coach Boone would allow me to come up with him and, you know, watch a practice. He let me be in the locker rooms before a game and listen to him talk to the team. So, and now I would see them out a little bit because, you know, at Robert Morris, you're still recruiting regionally. So I would see him on the road and his staff on the road and, you know, developed a really good relationship to the point where, he got the job at Eastern Michigan in 2000. And there was a couple guys that were not going with him from Robert Morris to Eastern Michigan. And again, our team doctor at Cal PA, I asked if he could talk to Coach Burson for me, and he did, and had a couple interviews with him, and it worked out. And I felt then, okay, now I'm going to start making some more contacts, having more connections. I've been really fortunate, wherever I've been, if I've advanced, like in that case, that was the team doctor at Cal PA that, believed in me, invested in my success, and, felt like he could put his name behind mine to recommend me for a job. And so that's how I got to the Division I level, and very fortunate to do that.
And look, it's cliche for a reason to say it's not what you know, it's who you know. In reality, it's who you know that opens the door. It's what you know and how well you work that allows you to progress. I think that's obvious to most everybody. But you get to that level. You wanted to be at Division I, and you are. And then would you say it was quicker than you expected, or was it kind of another one of those good fortune and networking had helped? When the opportunity comes to go to the Big Ten and go to the University of Michigan, talk about how that happened and then obviously, what your experience was like at Michigan.
Yeah, at that point, when I got the job at Michigan, I'm starting to think, wow, this is starting to become a whirlwind and I'm on the right track. I was my dad's freshman coach in 1992, and in 2002, I'm coaching in the Big Ten. So, obviously I feel like I'm on the right track. And but I did not know, Coach Amaker at that time. One of the associate ADs at Eastern Michigan when I was there, he's now the athletic director at Georgetown, Lee Reed, he knew Coach Amaker. And again, he called on my behalf. And I remember the story, him telling me, Lee Reed, that is, that, Coach Amaker wasn't, didn't really know me, didn't know if it would be worth bringing me down. And Lee Reed sold him on the fact that, I don't know if a lot of people know, Eastern Michigan and Michigan are 10 or 12 minutes from each other on the same road. So, it's, you can get from one campus to the other in 15 minutes. So Lee Reed told him, he told Coach Amaker, hey, you don't have to pay for a flight. You're not going to have to pay for his hotel room. Maybe you got to buy him lunch. So it's going to be a minimal expense to bring him down and spend a day with him. And he said, that's how he got Coach Amaker to agree to meet with me. And, from there, it went well. And, it was a few days later and he called and offered me the position. And, I know I bothered a lot of people doing this, but I grew up a Michigan fan, and that's with pretty much everybody in my immediate family being Buckeyes. And so I just remember when I didn't tell my family that I was going to interview at Michigan, but when I was offered a job, I called my dad and said, hey, I got another great opportunity. I got another job. And he asked where. And when I told him, there was a little silence. And I said, what do you think? He goes, I don't think that's going to be very popular with this family. I don't really care. So so that's how it worked out. Again, another guy, Lee Reed, who invested in me and put his name behind mine and, got me in the door there with, Tommy Amaker, who I just think the world of.
Well, we're going to probably go ahead and take our break a little early so we can come back and talk about that. But I am literally blown away by the fact that you didn't tell your family you were interviewing at the University of Michigan. There's no way I could keep that from the people that are close to me if that opportunity was on the doorstep. But we can talk about that momentarily. And you touched on a couple of names there. I think one of the funnest exercises in sport would be to get guys from this profession to just jot down the names of people that were instrumental in their advancement that nobody's ever heard of and is never going to, because we all have them. And I think it would make for a great story. But if you don't mind, I'm going to take just a short break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about your time with Tommy Amaker, and then we'll kind of quickly move through your other D1 experiences and get back into your decision to come back to high school.
Okay, sounds great, John.
Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and I just want to say thank you so much for listening to the Basketball and Life podcast. We are excited to announce that we have officially launched our website, bballandlife.com. That's bballandlife.com, where you can access all of our content, where you'll have opportunities for membership at $4.99 a month. You'll be able to gain a 10% discount on all merchandise available at bballandlife.com, as well as access to show notes and other content that we make available. We're also active on X. At B-Ball and Life Pod is where you can find us on X. We encourage you to reach out to us there, make suggestions, tell us how you feel about the show, what you enjoy about it, or what we might be able to do a little bit better. Again, our website is basketballandlife.com. All episodes are available, membership opportunities available at $4.99 a month that will give you a 10% discount on all merchandise and allow access to show notes and other content. And again, visit us on X as well, at B-Ball and Life Pod. Thanks again so much for listening. I hope you'll get over to our website soon. Okay, Andy, so you just mentioned that the pathway to Michigan, the people that were helpful, you end up one really big step closer to your ultimate dream of being a Division I head coach, and you're in the Big Ten. You're at the University of Michigan. It doesn't get a lot bigger than that, and you're also going to go to work for Tommy Amaker. Now, I'll say this, and maybe some people who aren't purebred basketball fans that listen to this might not know it, but Bill Brown, Jim Boone, we already mentioned Jay Burson. Those are some of the most respected guys in the entire coaching profession at any level across this country. And you're going to go to work for Tommy Amaker, who, to put it mildly, with respect to all of those guys, there's just a difference with Tommy Amaker's pedigree. Can you talk about what maybe struck you about Tommy Amaker right away? Because you go to work for a guy you don't know very well.
Yeah, the first thing that struck me was just how genuine he was. And just, you know, really down to earth, you know, Coach Amaker, you know, played at Duke for Coach K. You know, he coached, you know, he was a full-time assistant at Duke at a really early age and probably had a lot of reasons why he, you know, could maybe not be a very humble guy. You know, as an assistant coach, they won two national championships. And again, he had a lot of success as a player, but he was just a down to earth, genuine guy. You know, he wanted to talk about when in the interview, he wanted to talk about me. You know, I'd hear him talk much about himself. You know, he's just a really kind guy, along with the fact that he might be the smartest man I've ever been around too. So those were the thing that the genuineness was the first thing that, I noticed. And then just, you know, his intelligence, he could speak on any different topic and be very knowledgeable about it. And, he just, you know, it just kind of felt like home right away, where, you know, there's some other jobs, you know, it was actually a little bit later in my career. There's a couple jobs I interviewed for that, you know, I was a little bit more nervous. Once I got into it, I'm wondering how it's going. And with Coach Amaker, I just felt like the whole time, like, hey, this is going pretty well. This might work out. But he just made you feel good about yourself. And, it, you know, he was just a down-to-earth, genuine guy.
I've never met the guy, but I have spoken to several people who do know him or have met him. And that word that you use, genuine, I've heard other people use the word real. It seems to be the one thing that rings true about Tommy Amaker, that there aren't airs, there's no pretentiousness, there's just what he is what he is, and he leans into that. And so I guess that triggers a question for me. Like, his experience at Michigan was deemed unsuccessful, you know, in the general public eye. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like being there every single day and through some of that stuff that was a struggle? What do you attribute it to, and what did you gain from him during that experience?
You know, and I can, you know, we were let go because we didn't make the NCAA tournament. And I get that. At that level, you know, people's livelihoods are dependent upon whether you win or lose, period. But I've always told some people that ever wanted to talk with me, I would argue fiercely that we weren't successful at Michigan. And what I mean by is this. Coach Amaker's first year at Michigan, the FBI was still investigating everything with the Fab Five and what exactly went on there. So you can imagine in the first year in recruiting, people are hammering us about, you know, why would you want to go there? The FBI are investigating them. You know, they're going to have severe penalties. There was even at one point, yeah, you hear the word the death penalty. At the time, once everything was determined, it was the largest exchange of money between booster and players in the history of the NCAA. So, you know, they're using those kind of words. So you're getting hammered in recruiting. So at the start of the second year, the NCAA, you know, comes out with their findings. They ban us from postseason for 2 years, you know, scholarship limitations, official visit limitations. I mean, they hammered us pretty good. And, you know, we appealed that, and they actually took a year off of the postseason ban. So, you know, but even in that second year, you're still here, you know, you're still being recruited against, and they're like, well, they're on probation, they can't do this, they can't do that. So again, it's hard. And, but we finally started to get it going. And in 2004, we had a young team, and, you know, we went to the NIT, which was a big thing for us because we had a young team and we won it. But the thing about it was in 2004, no, it was a 2003. I mean, we were, I think we finished, you know, there weren't as many games. I think we finished either 10-6 or 10-8 in the Big Ten. And that was our year on probation. At that point, there had never been a Big Ten team with that record and not make the NCAA tournament. So, yeah, I'd like to think if, you know, if we'd have been eligible for postseason, we would have gone to the NCAA tournament because it had never happened before. But so we win the NIT in 2004, and things start to, you know, pick up, and we're getting some momentum in recruiting. You know, we're CBS, ESPN, we're starting to get a lot of, you know, live television games, live, I mean, just television games. And so our brand is getting out there even more. So it started, you know, we started to attract some bigger recruits. And what really hurt us, I think, in fact, I know in 2006, we had two guys that were committed to us. A guy named Al Horford, who's still playing in the NBA, had a great career at Florida. And then another kid named Joe Crawford, who was a top 35 player in the country. Well, right before the summer AAU season started, they both decommit and decide, you know, Horford went to Florida, Crawford went to Kentucky. And, you know, we've got one of the top – we go from having one of the top 10 recruiting classes in the country to basically off the map. At that point, we had one – it was going to be a three-person class, and now we're down to a one-person class, and we got to scramble for two more. And we got some pretty good players, but not nearly the type of player that Al Horford was or Joe Crawford. So that, to me, was kind of – that was a big blow that we never really recovered from. But when I think about when Coach Amaker took the program over and where it was when he left, I mean, there's a huge difference. And I know this – and nothing against Coach Beilein. He's one of the best coaches, you know, to ever coach in college basketball. But he took the program over in a really good position, as far as I'm concerned. He had a lottery pick there, which we recruited. He had two top 35 players in the country on that team. So he had where when Coach Amaker took over, it was tough. The talent was low, to say the least. So. But in our last 2 years, John, and not to get too long with this story, in our last 2 years at Michigan, you know, the Ohio State-Michigan football rivalry is the big thing, obviously, in football. Well, in basketball for Michigan, it's Michigan-Michigan State. And our last 2 years in the Big Ten, our league record was the exact same as Michigan State.
Yeah.
So. And one of those years, they went to the Sweet 16. So, I mean, when you think about that, we won 21 games three of our last 4 years. Our conference record combined in our last 2 years was the same as Michigan State. You know, we felt like we were getting this thing rolling. But, you know, we also felt like when we didn't get to the NCAA tournament in 2007, that it might happen, and it did.
Well, Andy, I think that is great perspective, because it's so easy from a historical perspective just to look at final records and say, well, these were good teams, these were bad teams. This coach, you know, Coach Beilein turned the program around, and again, outstanding coach, maybe as good as anybody that's ever done it, and a guy that you, if you can't respect John Beilein, I probably can't respect you. Right. He's one of those guys, but there is a reality in the line at that level of basketball between winning and losing and getting fired or keeping a job is so fine and is influenced by so many things that don't really have a lot to do with coaching. With your abilities as a coach. I mean, that losing two recruits, like you mentioned, that's a part of coaching at that level. You have to recruit, but that can happen to any guy at any time. And if it does, you're going to have a tough stretch. And so I appreciate you sharing all that and how difficult that had to be. But I know your respect for Tommy Amaker. You mentioned it in an email that we had exchanged earlier, and you've talked about it here. When that came to a close, I guess talk a little bit, if you would, about, you know, how you determine what's next for you and maybe what was Coach Amaker's role in trying to help you get to whatever was next.
You know, that was the first time that had ever happened. You know, they always say there's two kinds of coaches that have been fired and coaches that will be fired. And, but that was a real blow. I think a little bit too, because, you know, Michigan was kind of my dream job. I felt like we were doing a really good job, but you know, they obviously decided different. So it took a little while. I was kind of knocked back on my heels. Did a lot of thinking on, you know, what was next. And so Coach Amaker initially, he had said he was going to take the year off and maybe do some TV, which a lot of guys do. And at one point, though, he mentioned that Harvard had offered him the job at Harvard. And I said, what do you think? He goes, I have no interest. I said, okay. And we talk about different things. This goes on for a few weeks. Well, I get an opportunity to go interview at Virginia Tech with Seth Greenberg. You know, obviously Coach Amaker helped a lot with that. So the day before I left, you know, Coach Amaker called me and said, if he offers you the job on the interview, don't take it. He goes, ask for 24 hours. Don't take it right away. I said, why is that? And he said, I'm going to take the job at Harvard and I want you to come with me. And I'm like, okay. You know, if there's a better coach or better person out there than Tommy Amaker, I haven't met him yet. And so my first initial thought was wherever he's going, I'm going. So I go down there. And this isn't something I put in the email, but I was my day of the interview at Virginia Tech was the day of the shootings.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was. I remember getting up early. Coach Greenberg and I went to breakfast in the morning. And when we were still sitting there near the end of breakfast, and a couple of police officers kind of, you know, were hurrying out of the restaurant, and Coach Greenberg asked him, and he said, hey, there's been a shooting. Right outside of Castle Coliseum, which is the arena at Virginia Tech. But he told Coach Greenberg everything's fine now. So we finished breakfast. We go back. My first interview was with one of the associate ADs there. But they did find out two people were shot and killed at the dorm. Remember the name, Ambler Johnson dorm across from the arena. But there were two people killed there. So I go into this interview, and by the time I got out of that one, in fact, I think that one was cut short. Somebody came in to, his name was Dr. Tom Gabbard, came in and talked to Mr. Gabbard and said, hey, we got an emergency here. So basically at that point, the interview ended. I mean, I told Coach Greenberg, do what you need to do. I'll take care of myself. I'll just kind of hang out, you know, because he's got players on campus. His daughter went to school there. You know, there's a lot of people, you know, it's obviously a panic situation. So I ended up not really even interviewing. So because of what happened that day. And so when I got back, a couple of days later, Coach Amaker took the job at Harvard. And I remember him telling me, he said, Andy, I'm not even going to offer you the job right now. I said, why is that? He goes, because the pay is horrible. I said, oh, you know, Ivy League's, you know, They weren't paying a lot. They still don't pay a lot, although it's much better. But he goes, I'm not even going to offer you the job right now. He said, give me a few days. And so he took a few days and came back, and he said, this is what I can get you. And it was much better. But at that time, my wife was not working. We had kids, and I obviously at that time had a job where she didn't need to work. So we took a couple days to talk about it, and we had always moved based on my career and what was best for my career, my wife and I. And that's the first time she ever said, "I'm not comfortable with this." And I'm like, what do you mean? And she said, "How are we going to live in Boston with you making the amount of money that he had offered me?"
Right.
And she wasn't sure. She was a teacher for her first 10 years when we were up in Michigan, but she stopped because, you know, I had a job. She didn't have to work. And she goes, "There's no guarantee that I'm going to get a job." We started looking at things as far as housing. We would have probably had to live about an hour away from the university. And just for us to be able to afford it. And so she said she wasn't comfortable with that. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my profession or in my career to tell Coach Amaker I can't go. That's as hard as thing as I've ever done. But fortunately, Lewis Orr got the job at Bowling Green. I didn't know him either, but we had a couple mutual friends, you know, that we both knew, and he took a chance on me, and I ended up going to Bowling Green that next year.
And that year at BG, that's a short stint in terms of the time there, but again, just through mutual acquaintances and things, I hear a lot of interesting things about Lewis Orr and the type of person that he was and the coach that he was. A difficult time to be at BG, but your experience working with Lewis Orr, just maybe one or two takeaways from that experience with him.
Well, you know, when I say, you know, if there's a better person than Coach Amaker, I haven't met him yet. Now that I think about it, Coach Orr's right there with him. I mean, genuine guy, you know, strong in his faith, treats people the right way. Again, took a chance on me. So it was a tough first year. Coach Dockage was just let go at Bowling Green. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of, you know, talent in the program at that time. But, you know, I learned a lot from Coach Orr, and it was a different learning experience as far as how he handled things as compared to Coach Amaker and really for any other coach that I'd worked for. But he still got guys to play hard. They still trusted and believed in him. He just did it more of a mellow, in a mellow way. He was a very laid back guy. But it worked for him. And again, he'd been very successful where he had come from. So the only reason that I left after a year was because we were not able to sell our house in Ann Arbor. So I was driving from Ann Arbor to Bowling Green every day. Wow. And back. So that's about an hour and 15 minutes one way. So after, you know, that whole year and, you know, 2.5 hours, I did not want to leave Bowling Green, but that was right 2007, 2008, the housing market had crashed. We weren't going to be able to sell ours. And the head coach at Eastern Michigan that time, his name's Charles Ramsey. He and I were assistants together at Michigan. We worked together. And I actually lived in the same neighborhood with him. So he called me one day and said, "Hey, such and such left." And he goes, "Just why don't you come back up here and coach with me." He said, you'll be 5 minutes from work again. He goes, "I can pay you more." And he said, "I think we're going to be really good." And I didn't want to do it because I felt like it was a lateral move, not because I didn't want to go work for Charles Ramsey, but I just felt like at that point, my career was a lateral move, but because of travel, finances, it was the best thing for me and my wife at that time. So I went back up there.
Well, and Andy, the name of the podcast is Basketball and Life for a reason, because we could talk basketball and we could do X's and O's and we could get into all that stuff and it would be fun, but there's a zillion podcasts out there for that. The intersection of real life issues and basketball doesn't always get covered. People aren't always aware of it. And you talk about the reality of one going through a firing for the first time in your life and what that impacts in terms of your life. You talked very openly about a coaching decision being made largely because of your family situation. And it's not always cut and dry that you just take the next opportunity that looks good because of those things. And when you talk about not wanting to leave BG, but having to make a decision that was going to be dictated by finances and logistics. And yeah. The reality of it is Division I coaching is all-consuming and nearly impossible under the best of circumstances. I can't imagine a year where you're spending 2.5 hours a day in a car just to get to and from work.
Yeah, that was it was tough, and again, those were the factors that went into the decision to go back and coach at Eastern Michigan. And you know, I had a great experience there as well, but I certainly, if things would have worked out the way my wife and I wanted, you know, we were not going to leave Bowling Green.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you spent the next 3 years then with Coach Ramsey at Eastern, and then you were out of coaching in 2011, 2012. A couple of things. It'd be kind of a two-part question. One, what did you do during that time? And two, because of your time away from it, can you recall anything that you took away from that or that you gained from that experience that you found particularly valuable?
You know, I got out of coaching for that year because our first son, when he was born, he was diagnosed with sleep apnea, in a severe case of sleep apnea.
Wow.
So, and he had to go through surgery, and he was going at Mott Children's Hospital there at the University of Michigan, which there might not be a better children's hospital anywhere. So he was getting great care, but he was starting to have, with the breathing treatments we were giving him, he was starting to have problems. So, you know, I guess I'll go back a little bit. This is a funny story. You know, Coach Greenberg didn't hire me in 2007 because of that. Well, during that year, after the third year at Eastern Michigan, he had another job opening, and he offered me the job. And I was all set to go down to Virginia Tech this time. It was Memorial Day weekend, and again, my son was not doing well. And I'm thinking, I'm not taking him away from these doctors that he's been with, and, you know, the care that he's getting. And I wasn't going to leave my wife to handle all this herself because, you know, Coach Greenberg wanted me down there Memorial Day weekend, and she wasn't going to be able to come for maybe 6-7 weeks. And I just decided, hey, I need to take the year off. So I called Coach, and for sure he wasn't that very happy, but I think he understood the decision. So that year I was out, I worked at a technology company, and I worked for a guy that actually I knew in high school. He went to Pickerington, back when Pickerington was one school, and he went to Capitol, and I actually played against him. I played college tennis as well, so I had known him. And when he heard about it, he called me and said, you know, he's got his own technology company. He goes, I don't think you're going to stay out of coaching long, but so why don't you this year, you know, come work for me? And I'm like, I have no idea about technology. And he said, I just need you for your contacts. So the people that you know, you can get me in the door with those people, and then I'll take it from there. I said, all right. So I did that for a year. It was as boring as I could imagine, although this guy, Kevin, he was great to me. But you could tell it wasn't something I had any passion for. I actually, you know, get to work at 8, go home at 5. I didn't like that. I wasn't used to it, and I didn't like it. So it was one of those things where I knew at that point if my son got better and I had an opportunity to get back into coaching, you know, that I wanted to do it because I really missed it. It was, for me, it was hard watching college games at night on TV because I missed it so much. And fortunate for us that, you know, our son, you know, got better, and, you know, I was able to get back into coaching. And so after I take the year off, guess where I end up coaching? Virginia Tech. I get another opportunity to go down there. Coach Greenberg was let go, and one of his assistants got the job. And I knew this guy. He was an assistant at Penn State when I was an assistant at Michigan. So I, you know, got to know him that way and developed a relationship with him. So after two failed chances, now I'm on my way back to Virginia Tech this time to actually take a job.
And the VaTech experience, again, like many others, it wasn't a long-term deal. I think you were there for 2 seasons.
Yeah.
Just briefly here, talk a little bit, if you would, about having been now in the Big Ten, in the MAC, and now at Vatek in a completely different region, a completely different league. Can you talk a little bit about the differences in terms of style of play, how you guys had to coach, maybe what the emphasis were? Was it different from the Big Ten to the ACC, the ACC to the MAC? Were there marked differences in how you guys approach things?
Yeah, a big difference, you know, as a matter of fact. You know, in the Big Ten back in those days, you know, you had – it was a very physical conference. Big physical guys banging into each other. Not a lot called back. They let guys play. There were games that were – you know, played in the 50s. It just felt like, and I remember Coach Amaker hated that because, you know, coming from the ACC, that was quite a change. But there'd be games played in the 50s and 60s, and it just felt like every possession was so important because there weren't going to be many possessions in the game. And you kind of lived and died on one possession. So, you know, and now, again, you go from a physical league, you know, slow the ball down a little bit. You know, you got the shot clock, so you couldn't do it a lot, but lower scoring to the ACC where, you know, ACC is getting up and down the floor. They're scoring in the 80s, they're scoring in the 90s. I think the game was officiated different in the ACC as compared to the Big Ten, and not that that's a bad thing, it just was officiated different. So, yeah, the approach there was certainly different, and obviously the staff was different too, but the approach was different from Michigan to Virginia Tech, just in the way that you had to play. I mean, teams, because the league was like that, teams forced you to get up and down the floor and play. And that's how we did play. I mean, we had the nation's leading scorer and the ACC player of the year, you know, our first year there. So we did a good job, or we adapted to that situation, that environment. And, you know, we were able to do that as well. Just, you know, obviously the success was not there those 2 years we were at Virginia Tech. Again, that's a long story. The guy that got the job, you know, was the head coach for 2 years. And nobody, I don't think anybody can put their stamp on a program in 2 years, especially he took it over the year before. He was the head coach. They were last in the ACC. So, you know, I thought that was as unfair of I've seen a coach treated, to say after 2 years you're gone. But it was a new athletic director. New athletic director came in, and a lot of those people, they're going to bring their guys in right away. That's what happened, and so find myself looking for another job at that point.
I guess when you talk about the shift in how you guys were doing things from one league to the next, I don't think it gets, I guess, talked about often enough, that when you go into a league that has an identity, like it's probably, is it fair to say that you can't just decide I'm going to be me? Like you've got to fit into that region. You got to fit into, because I think I said this once before on one of my podcasts. If you go into a league like the Big Ten and you say, hey, we're going to stretch the floor defensively, we're gonna get out and press and trap and play fast and speed the game up, I'm not sure that's going to work. Even if you're good at it, I'm not sure in that league you're going to be successful. Versus if you go to the ACC and you say, hey, we'd like to play half court at a time, and we'd like to try to win games 61-56. You're probably not going to be successful, even if you're good at that. Is that a fair way to assess just the levels of basketball, or the overall approach to basketball at that level?
You know, I think it is, and just to, you know, piggyback on your point, we did try and do that. Again, I know Coach Amaker hated the style of play in the Big Ten. It was so much different than the ACC, where, you know, he spent so much time at Duke, where they scored in the 80s and 90s. So that's what we wanted to do, and we had some success with it. But when everybody else, and I'm trying to think, Illinois with D. Brown and Luther Head and Darren Williams, there was a couple teams that wanted to pick up the pace of a game. But when the majority of your league is playing that way, again, slow it down, physical, take good shots, you know, which everybody wants to do. But so it was, you know, we weren't able to actually get it to where we wanted to there. We were one of the more high scoring teams in the Big Ten. But as far as establishing that as, you know, what we were going to be, our identity was going to be, it was, it turned out to be, you know, hard to do that. So, you know, it's just, you know, the Big Ten was, you know, it was just, you know, you played in a lot of great games, a lot of great arenas, but the style of play, at least, you know, as a coach watching it, wasn't the most pleasing thing. I know that.
Well, I find it interesting that after your time at VaTech and it ended the way it did, look, Michigan's Michigan, the Big Ten's a Big Ten, the ACC's the ACC, you've coached in the MAC. There are certainly sexier stops on your journey than the Air Force Academy, but it might be the one that I am most intrigued by. You spent six seasons, I believe, as an assistant at Air Force Academy. We could spend a lot of time on coaching at a service academy, but based on what you had previously experienced, can you talk a little bit about how you handled becoming an assistant at a service academy and what that was like from a change standpoint in terms of how you had to approach things and what your day-to-day looked like?
You know, it's the best job I've ever had. I'll say that, working at a service academy and getting around, be around the people that you're around. When we got let go of Virginia Tech, the head, and you talk about, it's kind of, you know, a lot of it comes down to who you know. The head coach at Air Force at the time was a guy I was an assistant with at Eastern Michigan the first time, and I was an assistant with him at Michigan. So he's the head coach out at Air Force now, and he had an opening, and this is the shortest amount of time, you know, I ever had to look for a job. I bet from the time we got let go of Virginia Tech to the time I got offered a job at the Air Force Academy, it was maybe a week. It wasn't very long, so... But yeah, so we go out there. Colorado Springs is also the best place we've ever lived by far. It's a beautiful place. But the job, just, you know, I don't know if you have to change a whole lot as far as your coaching style. You know, these kids, you know, they want to be coached. I think they want to be pushed. Now, it was different from the standpoint, you know, when you're at the Air Force Academy, I personally think the Air Force Academy is the toughest job in college basketball, Division I. And you've got the other two academies, the Naval Academy and West Point, which have the same, you know, not restraints, but requirements that you're going to need to get into an academy. But, and no offense to anybody, they play against Lafayette and Lehigh and Bucknell and Colgate. We're playing against San Diego State, New Mexico. We're playing against some really, really good people. So, you know, when you look at it, first of all, you have to recruit, you get to recruit the best of the best, which that's, I like that, but you've got to recruit a kid. First of all, it's one of the best students in the country. Cause the requirements and the standard out there is so high. That person also has to want to be in the military. You know, has to want to go to a military school, wants to go through all that training for their commission when they graduate. They want to make a commitment for 5 years after graduation. So we brought most of our kids in through the prep school, which meant they were there for 5 years. Now they've got to commit for another 5 years. I couldn't remember what I was going to, I didn't know what I was going to do the week before when I was in high school, let alone commit for 10 years. So you've got to do that. So that's hard to find. Then they also has to be good enough to beat San Diego State and New Mexico and those types of teams. I think it's the toughest job in the country. There was, we're handicapped, I would say, handcuffed with what we could do as far as recruiting kids. Now, we had a lot of great wins. We beat San Diego State twice, and obviously they just played the national championship game. We had some really good wins. It's almost impossible to sustain it there. After the year of COVID, we were going to leave, but as far as a job, you get to be around some great kids. You get to be around great people. I still stay in touch, you know, pretty regularly with a couple of the generals from the Air Force Academy. You get to work with people like that. And get to see on a daily basis what these kids are doing and getting prepared for and serving their country. And, you know, with the whole coaching thing, I was a little nervous at first. And because, these kids are different from what any kid I've ever been around. I remember I went and talked to the football coach, Troy Calhoun, who's been wildly successful there. And I said, Coach, what? How do you coach? I told him I'd been a little nervous that first year, and he said, Andy, don't change anything. Coach them hard. Make them accountable. You know, you got to be tough on them. And I told him, I said, Coach, you know, I'll try to do a better job of that. But these kids at some point in their life are going to take an oath and a pledge that one day they might give up their life so I can have mine.
Yeah.
You know, to go fight for their country. And I'm like, that was pretty deep for me. So, because I just respected what they were going to do for their country. But I got better at that over time. I probably coached differently at the Air Force Academy than any other place I've ever been, just because of, you know, what that place meant, what those kids meant, and again, what they were going to do to serve their country when they left there.
Well, to spend a life that you did in coaching at the college level with the stops that we've already described, and come to the end of what was the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, you know, at Air Force Academy, I guess you and I had shared some, and you had shared with me about the kind of the decision that dream of being a Division I college head coach maybe isn't going to happen, and you start looking back in a different direction. Look, this may be an unfair question, but I think it's one that's worth asking. As you evaluate yourself and start looking at what's next for you, ultimately you're going to end up back in high school. Can you maybe tab two or three or one or two things that you were able to cull from those stops that were kind of in the category of when I become a head coach, wherever that is, these things are going to be important to me and my program?
You know, the Michigan experience and the Air Force experience probably shaped me as well as, you know, more than any two stops that I've made. And, you know, that last one again about, you know, that they have the integrity first, service before self, excellence in all you do, all we do. And, you know, I tried to, you know, when I came here, that's one of the things I've tried to do. And as far as integrity and being a role model for these guys, and then, you know, service before self, you know, I feel, you know, I'm fortunate to serve a school like Reynoldsburg and the players in it, and, you know, trying to be as excellent as possible. So I kind of took that as my guide a little bit, and hopefully I've been able to do that here a little bit. But just from a coaching standpoint, the coach that had the most influence on me was Coach Amaker, and how he did things, his philosophy. So that, as far as just the coaching aspect, that was the biggest influence on me.
So talk about, from your family's perspective, you know, getting to the end of the Air Force experience, ultimately, I guess detail for us, if you, what you can share about the conversations and the process in deciding that your opportunity to be a head coach is going to be in high school when you end up at Reynoldsburg.
Yeah. And that was a tough decision, you know, after being an assistant for 25 years, and to be honest with you, not really sure if I wanted to say, hey, this is it. It's time to adjust your goals. But, you know, after talking with my wife, and you know, we've got three kids at that point, and not that I didn't enjoy college coaching, I loved it, but the quality of life, especially at the Division I level, is not very good. You're traveling, with the recruiting calendar now in college basketball, there's only a couple times a year that you cannot be on the road. So, you know, the travel and time away from your family had gotten hard. And it just came down to, you know, when I saw this job became available again, it was the conference I played in, the conference that my dad coached in. My wife's from Reading, PA. We just decided that, and I guess more or less I decided, because if I would have, and I had a chance to stay in college basketball, but if I would, I just was done moving, moving them to another place. You know, there's no guarantees in college athletics that you know, you're going to keep your job. It's such a fluid situation. I just thought time for a better quality of life. It's time for a more stable situation. You know, let's go back. If I was able to get this job, let's go back and, you know, take our family to where I grew up, and only about 5.5 hours from my wife grew up, and now they can be around the grandparents more. you know, we're around friends. And again, it's going to just be a much more stable environment and a quality of life. So we decided to do it. You know, it was tough, but that was the first time too, for me, I guess that maybe meant I was growing up a little bit. It was the first time that, you know, we'd ever made a decision as a family that maybe wasn't exactly what I wanted to do, but because I wanted to stay in college basketball, at that point. But I said, you know what, this is going to be the best thing for our family, our kids. And so, again, it's time to do something different. It was a hard decision, but one I certainly don't regret now, that's for sure.
Well, that's the part, I guess, that I expected to hear, and I'm not surprised to hear that the hard decisions that you make together usually end up being the right ones. And yeah, and I think that certainly is the case. And when you mentioned the service before self thing, I mean, you're going to live that thing out when you make the decision that you made. You're going to live that as part of who you are, is, you know, serving a high school community, serving your family over yourself, and what maybe is still a realistic goal for you at that time. And when you are finally now in Reynoldsburg, and I don't care what level it is, because I can't speak to doing it at any other level other than high school, but when you become a head coach for the first time, you're still inheriting a program that you've got to assess, and you are looking at, okay, steps 1, 2, and 3, if you will, in establishing my program. Talk a little bit about what you inherited at Reynoldsburg, and what were your priorities in trying to make it yours and create the program that you wanted. I mean, I know it's a long process, but if you had to identify, you know, a couple of primary first day, first week, first month priorities, what were they?
You know, the program that I inherited was a good program. Seems like when coaches get jobs nowadays, they want to say, oh my gosh, I inherited a mess. You know, it's going to take years, and at least in college, it's going to take years and years and years. That wasn't the case here. The guy who was here before me, Scott Davis, I was friends with him. I knew him, and he was actually the first guy to text me and congratulate me when I got the job, which again says a lot about him and the type of person he is. So from that standpoint, you know, it was a good job. I don't know if they ever had great success, but they had plenty of success. So, you know, very fortunate to take over one of those situations. That usually is not the case, but, you know, I just kind of wanted to come in and with our staff, you know, create a culture where doing things the right way and having high integrity, was the first thing that we wanted to, you know, the first thing that we wanted to establish. And then with that, you know, the importance of being in the classroom. You know, I've been very fortunate to be at one of the three of the best academic institutions in the world, in the Air Force Academy, Michigan, and Virginia Tech, high academic places. So, you know, I certainly, that was kind of my background and what I believed in. So, you know, we talked about academics as well. So those were the, you know, the first couple things. And then you start, you know, thinking about how you want to play, how you want to be looked at, you know, by, you know, your opponent, by their coaches. And so, you know, we kind of came up, you know, as I've talked about, the way we're going to play and try to establish that kind of culture as well. I think we've done a pretty good job of doing that. But we've also talked to our kids a lot about, at least I tell them this, and I believe in it, you know, from my experiences and where I've been and who I've worked for, I always tell them, academics at the most should be your fourth highest priority. And I believe that. I've always told these guys that, you know, if you're, you know, faith, family, academics, if basketball is more important than one of those three, I kind of think maybe you've lost your way a little bit. I mean, those three things I think would always be more important than basketball or any sport that you might play. So we've talked to our guys about that. And
well, Andy, let me interrupt just for a second. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I'm glad you said it, because basketball as your fourth priority is a little bit of a different spin. I mean, most people, even in today's, you know, kind of cliche world that we live, it's always, well, faith, family, and basketball. That's the way it should be. Well, I'm glad you set the record straight. No, it shouldn't be. Faith, family, academics, and basketball is the way it should be. I can't emphasize that enough. I think we get so wrapped up in these catchphrases and things, and as so many guys have said, well, faith, family, and basketball. It's almost like you say it because you're supposed to. Well, if you're really thinking about it, yeah, the academics absolutely has to be ahead of basketball, and I don't care if it's high school or college.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. That's the one thing, you know, their faith, their family, academics, those are the three things that are going to sustain them through life. The chances of any of our guys, and I'm not trying to take anybody's dream away from them, but the chances of our guy, one of our guys, or anybody around here making life-changing money where they're not going to have to fall back on their education. They're going to make enough money, again, to take care of themselves and their kids' kids. I mean, it just doesn't happen very often. So I think those three things have to be a priority for them. And, you know, I think we've set that culture here. We've taken basketball away from guys and when their academics weren't where they needed to be. And maybe it's cost us a couple wins along the way, but, you know, again, I just think that you have to do it. We've got a great staff that believes in the same thing. And so, you know, I love basketball and I love sports, but at the end of the day, winning or losing an athletic contest really isn't that important, to be honest with you.
So the way we've been wrapping the podcast up for the last several episodes, Andy, is I have a segment that I call Two Whys and Two Whats.
Okay.
And it's two questions that start with why, two that start with what, and they're pretty simple, but I don't think the answers necessarily are going to be simple, so I want to give you enough time to answer it. First, why, and I think it's particularly pertinent to your evolution in this game and the journey that we've already described. As you sit here today and you get ready to start your fourth season at Reynoldsburg High School, with the career you've had, why do you coach? As of right now, what's your why for why you coach?
To make a lot of money. The first thing is, being around these kids, you want to do it to be around these kids. I really feel like, and not that, you know, you couldn't at the collegiate level, but I think this is a level you really feel like you can have an impact on a young man, and how they want to maybe carry on, in their future. So to make a difference in those kids, to help them develop, and I'm really fortunate. We have a great, great families here, and our guys have all been raised the right way. And so most of this has already been done, but, you know, I try and maybe add a little nugget along the way, and that hopefully something they can take for the rest of their life. But why, you know, to be around these kids and hopefully make a difference, in their lives, present them with some special moments in their lives that they'll never forget about basketball wise. So that's brought, that's the first thing, as far as why. Secondly, I want to be a part of something special, and I want these kids to be a part of something special. And, I think we have a chance to do that here. I was fortunate to get the job at a time where we had a lot of young talent in the program. And, for the most part, they're all Reynoldsburg kids. And so I'd like, for them more than me, I've had a chance to have some of those moments, but I want those guys to experience it as well too, to win a championship. We haven't won one here. We went to two district finals and got beat, but I want these guys to experience that and just have these memories for the rest of their life. Hopefully we're close to that.
So the second why question, and we've talked throughout this podcast about playing for your dad, playing for Jim Burson, working for Bill Brown, working for Jim Boone, and through the list. Tommy Amaker was obviously a huge impact. But at the end of the day, you have a way that you do things. So my second why, in addition to why do you coach, is why do you coach the way that you coach?
I would say, the biggest influence was, I coach the way I coach because that's what I saw with my dad. And, he was very successful, as a high school coach. So, that's just his influences, Tommy Amaker, if I had to say somebody was a mentor to me, it was him. But with my dad, he just did things a certain way that I've always appreciated, as far as, holding people accountable, you know, making sure you don't let kids slide. I think that's the worst thing you can do as a coach, you know, to let a kid slide and do things the wrong way. I don't think you do that. You're not helping anybody by doing that. So, you know, he's a big part of it. As far as why, you know, cause I think he would be proud of the fact he saw me coach at all those places except here at Reynoldsburg. And I think he'd be proud of what I've done and been able to do in coaching. I certainly feel fortunate. So, you know, that's another thing, you know, for my dad, why do I go, you know, for my dad, and, you know, hopefully he's proud of me and what I have been doing.
And that leads me to the what questions. And try to think from the perspective of the guys that you have coached and all your stops, but particularly now as a head coach, what is it like to be coached by you?
You know, I hope it, you know, they would say, you know, it's tough. It's demanding. Again, we hold people accountable, but at the end of the day, I also hope they feel like, you know, not just me, but this staff has their best interest at heart, and we want what's best for them. And again, a lot of it that has to do with, does not have to do with basketball, that, you know, we do care about them. I think, you know, I think our guys, you know, we work hard. So that those would probably be the, you know, the things that I think our guys would say about being in our program, and I guess being around me and our assistant coaches. And, you know, again, I guess that's the best way I think to do it. Cause I've seen some guys do it and be successful. Now they might add some things that I don't really want to hear. But, I hope that those three or four things are things they would say if asked.
And then final question, I'll have one wrap up comment to tie back to early in the podcast, but the final what question is, what is your definition of success now?
For me or for our players?
For your program.
You know, I just think to be the best that we can possibly be, to compete at the highest level. And when I say compete, really, you know, I'm not saying necessarily win at the highest level, although we all want to do that, but to compete at the highest level, know that even if we don't win, we did deserve to win, that we put work in, that type of work to win. You know, it's, well, I'm trying to think here, you know, it's something where, you know, where you're all, you feel like you're all pulling in the same direction for one common cause and one common goal. And you develop a lot of those relationships along the way. Cause let's face it, the relationships are always going to last, you know, winning a game against whoever, in 2004 in the OCC, they're going to forget that stuff. It's the relationships that you build along the way are the things that are going to make the biggest difference.
And so I want to tie back to I said we were going to put a pin in and come back to it. You said early in the podcast that at heart you are a Division III guy.
Absolutely. That's
Division III college basketball. So I want you to respond to this in whatever way you think is appropriate, but I'm going to ask it as a true or false question. True or false, is being the head basketball coach at Reynoldsburg High School gets you closer to being a Division III guy than you would have been if you were a head coach of a Division I college program?
So you're saying
are you closer to that
Division III head coach?
Yeah, are you closer to doing what Division III guys do, doing what you do now, or would you be closer if you were a college head coach at the Division I level?
I think probably, you know, with my background now being a high school head coach, and if you're having success, then I think some of those people would want to reach out to you to maybe be a Division III head coach. I cannot think of any scenario or any situation that I would do it. I've loved it here. I love the guys we have. I love the support we have. I work for really great people that, again, invest in us. So, you know, there are some times, there have been a couple times when I've thought along the way, you know, and if I wasn't so arrogant to think I was going to be a Division I head coach, why didn't I pursue the Division III route early on? Because as you know, there's some great Division III jobs where you can have a great quality of life, but also be in a situation where you can compete at a high level. And so I think about that a lot. You know, at the end of the day, I wouldn't change my path and where it's taken me. But at this point, as far as, you know, being a Division III head coach now, you know, if that's the question you were asking,
I guess what I was really kind of focusing on is what you're doing at Reynoldsburg. You kind of get to run a high school program that can more closely resemble what Division III basketball is.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, I got you. Say yeah, definitely. And I'll be honest with you, we try and run this as much, or you know, I try and, you know, pattern the stuff, you know, that we do around what is done at the college level and specifically the Division III level, you know, having that experience. And you know, so yeah, I think that's very true. And I think we do that. And again, I think it's a successful way to do it. You know, and I think our guys have really accepted and adapted to it. So yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that's very important. And, you know, it's, you know, again, something that our guys, the transition has been made easy because of them. And that's one of the things I'm the most appreciative for is these kids and their parents and the support that we've had here.
Well, Andy, Reynoldsburg High School's got a new fan in me. I can't wait to see your progress over the course of this year. I know, you know, again, it's very cliche to say, hey, you got to get, you know, at the end of year four, you'll really have your things established. I've heard that at the college level forever, but you're going into year four at a high school program that you know, maybe has a chance now to really fully become what you envisioned when you took over the program. So I wish you nothing but the best. I know we've been at this a while. You've been more than gracious with your time, and I just want to say thanks and wish you absolute nothing but the best going forward.
I appreciate it. I'm glad you say you're a fan. We needed one, and I'm glad you're now on board with us. So yeah, if you have time to come down and see us play, I know you're in the college profession yourself. Come down and see our guys, recruit our guys. You'd certainly be welcome anytime. We'd love to have you down.
Well, you've got a name for me that I'll get when we get done recording here. But if I make the trip down, I'm going to do everything in my power to swing through Marion and grab Marty Riggs, and we'll come down together.
Yeah, that'd be great. And I'll let you guys buy me dinner.
That is perfect. Well, it'll be me buying. I can tell you this, Marty's not going to part with any of his money if he doesn't have to.
That sounds like Marty. I agree.
All right, buddy. Listen, take care of yourself, and I hope we can catch up soon.
Thanks for everything, John. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's me again. Before we get out of here, I want to say thanks again for listening to the Basketball and Life podcast with Coach John Cook. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. More importantly, hope you'll revisit us to check out other episodes in the future. And don't forget, you can visit our website, bballandlife.com. That's bballandlife.com to access any of our episodes or content that you enjoy or would like to check out again. Again, visit us at bballandlife.com. There's also membership opportunity available for you there as well. And you can get 10% discount on any and all merchandise available at bballandlife.com. If you or anyone you know might be interested in using our podcast to advertise for your business, you can email me at bballandlifecoachjohncook@gmail.com, and we can discuss advertising opportunities there as well. Again, thanks so much for listening to the Basketball and Life podcast. Hope that you'll visit us again soon.